Penguin Random House Audio presents Providence by Caroline Kepnes, read for you by MacLeod Andrews, Emily Rankin, and Paul Michael. It is true, we shall be monsters, cut off from all the world. But on that account, we shall be more attached to one another. Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley, Frankenstein. Nashua.
John. I brung Pedro home for Thanksgiving break, and tomorrow I have to bring him back to school. You're not supposed to say brung. You're supposed to say brought. But I like the way brung sounds, like you're cold and ringing a bell. Brung! Nobody can kick your ass for what you think in your mind. Not even your mom. Mine is stirring spaghetti sauce on the stove and shaking her head at me. Get that rat out of my kitchen, she says. Pedro's not a rat, I say. He's a hamster. My mom doesn't budge. Whatever he is, he's not staying in my kitchen. I'm not going to keep repeating myself, John. Take that thing outside now. She always calls it my kitchen, same way my dad calls the TV my TV and the puffy chair my chair. My only territory is my bedroom. I guess my shed, too, but that's in the woods and technically it belongs to Mrs. Curry. Everything else, in the house, indoors, belongs to my parents. I take Pedro outside to the swing set, even though I'm too old for it. He shivers. Come on, little guy, I say. You're from New Hampshire. You can handle it. The truth is, I don't know if Pedro was born here. Maybe he was born in Bermuda and got shipped here. This is my home, where I started. I was born at Derry Hospital outside of Nashua, 3 days before Carrig Burkus. Sometimes, when he's kicking my ass, I think about how we were in the hospital at the same time. I picture us as newborns in nearby cribs. I see our dads waving at us. We were equals, in a way. Back then, you probably couldn't tell us apart. But now, we're opposite. Carrig is a jock, one of those guys with buddies. His life is keg parties and girls. He cracks a joke and everyone laughs, and he knows how to speak to people, how to get to them. Last month, his picture was in the window at Rolling Jack's, the sports store in the mall. He was athlete of the month. I'm not anything of the month. Chloe laughed when I said that to her. That's a good thing, she said. The worst thing you can do is peak in middle school. She always says the right thing, the nice thing. I can picture her photo and her name up at another store. Person of the month. I'd never say that, though. I know that much. Tomorrow we go back to school, which means seeing her again. Chloe smells like cookies. That's what I call her in my head. Every time my mom makes cookies, no matter what they are, oatmeal, raisin, or chocolate chip, or caramel, they smell like Chloe. Chloe smells like cookies doesn't make fun of me. She sits with me at lunch, even though the other girls laugh at her, and the other guys tell her she is wasting her time on a faggot. Chloe hates that word. She says after high school, she's going to live in New York City where nobody uses that word. She thinks the people in our school have small brains and small hearts. She says New York is like Sesame Street for grown-ups. Everyone has big hearts, and you can be anything you want to be. She was there for Thanksgiving this week. Her parents took her to see the parade. She saw all the floats when they were shriveled and flat on the ground. We've been texting a lot all week. She says, I'd love New York. It's so much bigger than New Hampshire, even though it's smaller, you know? I get it, Chloe. I wish I was there. Of course you do. You always get it. My mom yells, Denna! I write back fast, see you tomorrow. She sends me a smiley face. That's code for me too, John. The house smells like spaghetti and broccoli, and my mom asks if I left Pedro outside, and I tell her I did, even though he's in my pocket. My dad picks up the broccoli and puts it in the microwave. What are you doing? My mom asks. It's cooked just fine.
I can't stand that smell, he says.
It's good for you, that smell. My dad grunts. He's a burly guy who does drywall and plays pool. A lot of the guys around here think he's weird because he has a Scottish accent. I sneak bits of spaghetti into my pocket. I almost get away with it, but Pedro nips at my finger and I yelp and my mom slams her fork down. These damn schools. What the hell is there to be learned from taking a rat home at your age? Aren't you a little old for this nonsense? We're mentoring a class at the elementary school, I tell her. None of the kids in third grade could take him, so I volunteered. My parents look sad. Like all this time they thought Pedro was here because he had to be here, not because I wanted him. A lot of people have pets, I say. Carrick Burkus has a dog. I shouldn't have said his name. They know I'm not friends with Carrick Burkus anymore. The last time he invited me to a birthday party was in fourth grade, when people still had parties with invitations, when your mom made you invite every kid. It was a Batman invitation, so I showed up in my Spider-Man outfit, but everybody else was in normal clothes. Sometimes I feel bad for my parents, like they'd do better with one of the other babies from that day. The kind who plays sports and wears the right clothes to a stupid party. I look at my mom, right at her, like you do when you want something. He's a clean animal, I say. I promise he will stay in my room. My mom cuts her spaghetti. She doesn't roll it around her fork like people in New York do on TV. Her name is Penny, and she's from New Hampshire, so she talks the way people here talk, and she grew up on a farm where the animals stay outside. It's your room, she says. You want to live in a disgusting pigsty and let animals poop about your things, that's your business. Just don't go coming to me to clean up. On the way upstairs, I sneak a box of Oreos out of the cupboard. My dad is talking to my mom about the Patriots and the Super Bowl, and my mom is talking about Giselle and how beautiful she is. They speak the same language, only different. What comes out of my mom's mouth never affects what comes out of my dad's mouth. I think Chloe and I are better at talking. What Chloe says always affects what I say. Upstairs, I put Pedro on my bed and bring an Oreo up to my nose and inhale. But Chloe smells like homemade cookies. I take out today's Nashua Telegraph and reread Pedro the headlines from this morning. Today is Sunday, the biggest paper of the week. I can't read the whole thing to Pedro, but I do my best. We make it to Section C, Lifestyles, and I think he likes it. I love news. It reminds you that there's a whole world out there. A world of people who have never even heard of Carrick Burkus. Every day is new. Every paper, every story. In a book or a movie, you only get one story, but in a newspaper, you get happy stories, sad stories, stories that you can't understand about mortgages, scary stories about robberies, meth heads, that kid who got kidnapped in Dover. Last Christmas, my parents got me a subscription to the Telegraph. It was all I wanted. I was nervous they weren't going to get it for me, and I opened my last present, a sweater box. I was bummed, but I tore away the tissue paper and found a receipt for a subscription. I cheered, and my mother laughed. I love it when she laughs, and it doesn't happen a lot. She said she will never understand me. I hate newspapers, she said. Who wants to know about all the terrible things people are doing? I want to know about everything, I told her. But it has absolutely nothing to do with you whatsoever, John, she said, befuddled. Nothing in there is your business at all. My dad was tearing the tag off his Patriots jersey. Well, I said, those Patriots don't have anything to do with Dad. I never heard my mom laugh so hard. She hit the couch, and my dad flew into a light rage, telling me it's not those Patriots, it's the Patriots. We had ham and cake and peppermint ice cream, and the only thing wrong about that day was that there was no newspaper. They don't publish on Christmas. Then again, it only added to the joy of the next day when I woke up early to get the paper out of the special box my dad had installed next to our mailbox. It was good to see that the world was back on again. When it's time to go to bed, I make a special place for Pedro. I use advertising flyers to build him a cozy bed. My mom is crazy. There's nothing dirty about him. If and when he poops, it won't even get on my sheets. Good night, Pedro, I say. I close my eyes, and I like the sound of him breathing, like it's a hard thing to do. The next morning, my mom hits my door once. School! It's what she says every morning. Pedro pooped in his advertising bed, and I crumple it up and bring it downstairs and throw it in the trash in the kitchen. My mom points at the trash with a spatula. Is there poop in there? Yes, I say. Then bring it outside. But it snowed. And since when are you allergic to snowflakes? I take Pedro and his bed outside and look at the trees at the edge of our yard. My mom and dad don't know that it takes double the time for me to get to school every day because I have to go the back way through Mrs. Curry's yard with the thorns that branch out, then alongside her fence and through the mud clearing near the dumpsters, and then back through the Shawnee family's yard by their swing set, and then finally down their driveway and onto Carnaby Street where my school is. It would be so much faster to walk out the front door of our house and turn left and walk down Birch all the way to Carnaby. That's what everyone on my street does. But I can't. Carrig and Penguin and those other guys, they come after me if I go the short way. They pound on me. They take my newspaper and smack me with it, or they throw snowballs at me, black and brown and icy, the kind that hurt. When it's hot out, they jump me or knock my bag onto the ground. Chloe Smells Like Cookies takes the bus. She knows about my backway bramble route to avoid Carrig Burkus. She knows everything, more than my mom or my dad or the teachers. She's the only person who knows about my shed, our shed. I go there every single day after school and I bring fluffernutters. Some days I hear her coming and my heart beats fast. And then she comes in, throws her backpack down and starts complaining. Other days she doesn't come, and it starts to get dark, and I go online and see that she's busy with her other friends. But those days she does come, when I hear her in the woods, charging toward me, those are the ones that count. Chloe always says we get along because we're both only children. She hates that phrase. It's bad any way you cut it, she said once. It's either like, oh, you? What do you matter? You're only a kid. Or it's like, you're just not enough because there's only one of you. And then she licked her lips and looked away. We're not only anything, she said. We're great. See, I have that going for me, being an only child. Carrig Burkus, he has four brothers and a couple sisters. Imagine living with all those kids. I can't, not really. Me and Chloe, we have more in common. My mom opens the slider. She yells, breakfast! Inside, she made burnt eggs and bacon, and my dad is reading the paper. He gets to have it first, and he gives it to me section by section. I put the pages back together so that it feels new, like nobody has looked through it. The good thing is that most days he only reads the sports section. So, at the end of the year, somebody gets to keep Pedro, I say. My mom looks at my dad, and my dad puffs out his cheeks, and my mom groans, and my dad looks at me. You keep him out of your mother's kitchen, yes? Yes, I say, and I can't wait to get to school and tell Mrs. McMurphy that I want to keep Pedro. I can't wait to tell Chloe Smells Like Cookies. I think you can invite a girl over without weirding her out if you have a pet. I think that's why Carrig Burkus has a dog. I can't get to school fast enough. I tear through the brambles, and I'm out of breath, as if I'm running from bad guys. I run too fast, and a thorn snags me. My cheek bleeds. I stop. I take off my glove and put my hand on my face. There is bright red blood. Pedro is in my pocket, shifting. I take him out, and now there is blood on him. I apologize. I hear something in the bushes, though there is never anyone else here. I turn around, and my whole life doesn't flash before my eyes. Just the past few hours, the headline on the cover of today's paper. Cyber Monday. Is it worth it? And the smell of last night's broccoli against the morning eggs. Pedro's heavy breathing. The snow. My blood on Pedro's Ovaltine-colored fur. But it isn't one of the kids from school coming at me. It's a sub we had last year, or the year before. Mr. Blair. Nobody liked him. He wore his phone on his belt, and he was losing his hair on the top of his head, and people laughed at him all the time. But I didn't. I didn't. He's coming at me fast, and it turns out I am not the kind of kid who springs into action when it's time to fight. I freeze. I choke. Same way I do on the baseball field at recess. The blow comes from high above, and something hits my head. Brung! Pedro runs when I hit the ground. He can't send help. He's an animal, and like my mom says, he belongs out here. I don't.
Chloe. They can't find John. When he wasn't here, they called his mom and she said he wasn't homesick. She came to school, his dad too, and the whole school started to buzz. In that sick way, like when Kitty Miller got leukemia. People get excited about horrible things happening when they're not happening to them. I'm no better. I remember staring at Kitty, wondering what it was like to be her, as if she was a painting and you were allowed to gawk at it. Kitty was loved. People made cards for her. With this situation, people are acting like it's news, like it's exciting. That John kid might be missing. The day is halfway over and he's not at school. He's not at home. He's not at the movies and he's not at the mall, but did they look in all the right places? Most kids who run away would go to a packy and rip off beers, get messed up, and then go to Rolling Jack's and try out new hockey sticks. But John would never do that. I told them to start in the woods. I told them how he takes a weird way to school. I didn't mention why. It's a hard thing, wanting to find him, but also not wanting to look at a cop and be like, John had to take the long way through the woods because he was getting picked on at the bus stop. I think the cops get it anyway, though. They're searching, but they still haven't found him. I wish the school day would end because when it does, I'm going to the shed. I don't like the way everyone assumes the news is going to be bad. They act like he's already dead. Like if he's not at the movies and he's not at the mall and he's not in the woods, then where could he be? You can feel what it would be like if someone else disappeared. Someone like me or Carrig. Someone people love. John Bronson was not loved when he was here, and so he's not loved when he is gone. It's nobody's fault. It just is. At free period, Noelle and Marlene and I meet up at our round table in the library. It feels wrong. Acting like John isn't missing. He says things to me. Things that don't count when they come from your mom, your dad. He thinks I'm special. I sent him a filtered picture of the floats in New York last week, and he was so impressed. I laughed it off. It's not me, it's the filter. He was so serious. No, it is you. You used the right filter, framed them just right. John is my champion. That person who sees more than what's there. I sent the same picture to Marlene and Noelle, and they just sent back heart emojis. And you need that too, people who don't put you on a pedestal. Everything between John and me is a secret. he wouldn't leave without telling me. When I say this, Marlene and Noelle look at their phones. He's fine, Noelle says. You need to chill. Marlene says it's weird he didn't text me. Is he mad at you about that thing with the frog picture? Noelle snaps at her. Leave it alone. The frog picture. The thing I've tried so hard not to think about all day. A few days before the Thanksgiving break, John brought this old stuffed animal to the shed. This frog, this soft green thing he loved as a baby. There was something painfully vulnerable about the whole moment. There, he said. Shed, sweet shed. The frog was up there like taxidermy, as if this was a home. John's way of pushing us together. My heart was pounding. He was reading this book about marshmallow fluff and talking about the history of fluff, the machines, the secrecy surrounding the recipe. I couldn't process his words. I couldn't take my eyes off that frog. Is this what I want? We've never hooked up, not even a kiss. John was reading a passage from his fluff book out loud, and I was taking pictures of that frog. I put one up online. I knew what I was doing. It was a dog whistle to Carrig. Within a few minutes, Carrig was at the shed, pounding on the door. Chloe, lose that faggot and come hang with us! Carrig was with Penguin, saying terrible things about John. And then Carrig's BB gun went off. A single pop. No one was hurt. Nothing was hit. It didn't matter, though. You gotta go, John said. Don't worry about me. They just want you. Now he's missing. And this is the world without him. Noelle shakes her head. And what were you supposed to do? She says, sit there with him until Carrig tore the walls down? Chloe, that whole thing has nothing to do with this. I nod. Noelle is naturally authoritative. She says things and you believe them even if you don't. I know, I say. I just hope John didn't run away. Marlene shakes her head. He didn't, she says. I mean, that kid would never leave you, right? On we go, a dark version of a normal day. Noelle digs up terrible facts, the odds of John being dead. She chews on her Dartmouth pen. Everything, everyone reminds me of John. I look at Noelle. I remember telling John she hates the middle. He said a sense of humor is like a sense of smell. Some people don't have one. See, that's why I miss him. Why he's the best. He's funny. He gets it. What other kid, what other boy, would like the middle? He says it's great because all the hecks are smart and stupid at the same time. He says most other shows make you be one or the other. Shit, Marlene says. Her laces are tangled. That's Marlene in a nutshell. She cares about what's happening in front of her face, the laces on her shoes, the tennis balls on the court. It would be insane of me to expect her to be the kind of friend who cries with you. And the same is true of Noelle. Noelle and her Dartmouth pen and her class rank. They're both very intense. John is more like me. His heart spreads out in the stupidest ways. He cares about things easily, things that don't matter to anyone else. The history of the marshmallow fluff in his sandwiches. The class hamster. Listen to what Penguin just put on Snapchat, Noelle says. Ugh, Penguin. Again, I'm thinking of that night, the green frog beating in my mind like a slimy heart. The white and black of Penguin's trademark Bruins jersey. Kerrig's scent. Gunpowder. Sweat. Noelle drones on, and what if John is here, in the library, crouched in the stacks and listening? What if he can see this? Us being normal? Talking about Penguin, who is just a loser, he'd never move to New York like John and I will. John. I remember in fifth grade. I told him how Noelle said I was pretty but not slutty pretty, and he said I'm pretty pretty. But then he never said it again. And that's when things felt settled or something, like we were just friends. And I was young, I was fine with it. Noelle and Marlene and I were all young for our age, hunched over our bagged lunches, no idea how to talk to boys. And here we are years later, still no idea, the way Noelle gushes about Penguin. I squeeze my milk carton. I miss John. And he is missing. Is this real? Noelle winks at me, calm down, and Marlene pushes my milk carton with her ruler. They're not bad people. They just don't get it. Sorry, I say, shaky. I'm just in shock. Noelle sighs. You can't act like this is your thing, see? You guys are buddies, but you scribble Chloe Burkus all over your diary, and I know you hang with those guys at 40 Steps. My cheeks turn red. It's true. I hate that it's true. I hate that she can be mean and cold and right all at once. Anyway, I say, what did Penguin say? Well, she says, all gossipy. Penguin's dad's a cop, and he told Penguin's mom that John's parents told the cops that John was sleeping in bed with the hamster. Marlene shakes her head. I'm gonna pee. When she's gone, it's just me and Noelle, like it was when we were little, before Marlene moved here and made us into three best friends instead of two. Noelle clicks her pen. Chloe, she says. Does John really sleep with the hamster? It's not a fair question. John loves Pedro. Kerrig's family has a golden retriever. Nobody makes fun of him. You can love a dog, you can't love a hamster. I shrug. No idea, I say. Why? All day I am more aware of how close John and I are. He has nobody but me. Nobody knows him like I do, and there's this pressure building every hour that he doesn't show up. The bell rings. Noelle pops her pen. Hey, she says. You know I'm only giving you a hard time because I know everything is going to be okay. For the most part, everything is always okay. Your little friend is probably at Tenley's having a frappe. I think of the red and white stripes on the Tenley's straws. The awnings. John likes it there. A lot of kids think it's for babies and old ladies. Every time you go, you hear, "You got it all by the Jets," at least twice. My mom always looks around. Didn't they just play this? John loves that song. The video, too. It's all frappes and puffy clouds. Sweet things. John things. When Marlene comes rushing back to grab her books, late, same as always, when we're walking down the hall talking about nothing, it feels like Noelle is right, like everything will be okay. After school, I take the bus and get off at the stop closest to Mrs. Curry's. I sneak through the woods, and I run. I want him to be in the shed. He has to be in the shed. I knock on the door. John? He doesn't answer, but then he knows I never knock. I remember this morning, the policeman asking me who else he could talk to about John. Other kids. No one, I said. Just me. I open the door. but John's not there. For weeks, I harassed my mother about these bright white boots I found online. John knew about them. I showed him a picture. And what will happen after you get these magic boots? I'll wear them and I'll be happy. And then what? We were on the floor of the shed. It was a few days before Thanksgiving break. We were watching the middle and talking about nothing. The question haunted me. And then what? I didn't have an answer then. I don't have an answer now. The day before he disappeared, he sent me an article from the Telegraph, a meteorologist predicting less snow this winter. "Show your mom and she'll get you the boots," he said. My mom broke down last night when she overheard me crying. So now the boots have arrived. "This is a mistake," she says. "These boots will help for a minute, and then they will only hurt you. They'll only remind you of this mess." "You think he's gone, don't you?" She doesn't answer me. We're both picturing the same thing. John dead. She breaks the silence. "You better hurry. We're going on a search party. It's day 5, and John is out there. Who knows where?" I feel the reflexive spike of adrenaline as I tear into the brown box, the scent of new shoes, the pleasing pink tissue paper, the shiny sticker, how easily it gives. The boots are as pictured, impractical, but I wanted them. And when your best friend disappears, you get what you want in other ways, lesser ways. We haven't even started walking yet, and I'm pretty sure I have a blister. The police are here. Some people from town I don't know. Some kids. The Girl Scouts made little sustenance brown bags, cookies and nuts, and bottles of water so small you can down them in one gulp. Rolling Jack's donated hand warmers. I heard a kid from my algebra class say he only came for the free stuff. But people often say things like that to deal with their own fear. At least, I hope that's true. Noelle glares at the boots as soon as she sees me. "Jesus," she says, "are those the ones you showed me online?" I wish I hadn't shown them to her. I wish the cop who heard her say that knew that I showed them to her before John disappeared. "Yes," I say. "Is Marlene here yet?" Noelle rubs her hands together. "No," she says. "But there's a van from Channel 5. The cop is young, and he touches his holster a lot. His cheeks are red from the cold, from being young.
"You're the friend, right?"
Noelle locks her arm through mine, proving that she wants in on the drama. Any drama. All drama. "We are the friends, officer. I'm her best friend, and John was like, well, we're the best friends." He nods.
"Are you expecting more people?" he asks.
And then they both look at me, Noelle and the cop. And other people, too. John's parents, his crying, chain-smoking mom, his sad, drinking dad, the lonely girl from my gym class, the foster kid who shows up at school before the doors open, a couple other parents. They must know John's parents. It's a horrifyingly small group, and I look down at my white boots. My mother steps forward. I forgot she was here. "Officer," she says, "I can hold down the fort and follow with all the latecomers." In the movies, when you see people searching for the missing kid, there's a wall of people. Their voices overlap, and you get the sense that even if it's not today, someday they will find the kid. We are the opposite of that.
We're a thin crowd. Uneven. John's mom is crying and she fights with the cops a lot.
I swore there was something up that tree. The birch tree back there. You didn't see the guy in that house? The split level? The peeling paint? You don't think he was a weirdo? Who sees this happening and closes their blinds? Can't you send someone over to talk to him?
There are so few of us that you can't have a private conversation. There's no din where it's okay for me and Noelle to talk about random things. But we're just big enough and spread out to the point where we can't have one conversation as a group. Officer Young Gun leads the way with his flashlight and his megaphone. John's dad is full-on drunk, and he sings.
Counting the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike, they've all come to look for America.
The more we walk, the more he drinks, the less sense it makes, the more it feels like this is a dead end. At some point, I don't fight the tears. Noelle squeezes my arm. It's okay, Birdie, she says. She hasn't called me that since we were little kids, and it isn't okay, and I'm not Birdie, and I'm crying because we can't find John, because my ankles are bleeding, because the blood is going to soak through the white leather, because the brain is a horrible thing, how much it can hold. My mother was right. The boots were a mistake. When we get back to the shed, my mom is sitting there with her Kindle. She shoves it into her bag and fixes her hair like a married woman who was caught making out with the real estate agent. No one else showed up, she says. Did you have any luck? The news team is still there. Only one van stayed. My mom says they want to talk to me, and they have a camera with a bright light. The guy has the whitest teeth I've ever seen, whiter than my boots. He asks me about our search, and I open my mouth to answer, but he winces.
Can you step 3 feet to the right? We need to fake a crowd. It's just better that way.
At home, I bury my boots in the back of my closet near my old dance recital costumes. I soak my feet in the bathtub and think about all those stupid things I said to the TV man. They asked me to talk to John in case he can hear me, and I looked into the camera and smiled. John, I said, one thing you don't have to worry about is the telegraph. I'm saving them all for you, even the circulars and the coupons. And of course I have the comics. I smiled, as if I was so afraid for people to know how sad I am. As if crying is something I can only do here, in the bathtub over my poor bloody ankles. When I get out and go back to my room, I can tell my mother was there. There's a brand new box of Band-Aids on my bed. She's folded over the sheets like she did when I was little. There are no more tears left in me right now, and I pick up my phone, but I don't have many pictures of John. He hated having his picture taken. Hates. I sneak down the hall to my mother's office and steal one of her yellow legal pads. Back in my room, I lock my door. I hide under the covers with a flashlight. I try to draw his face, to recreate it right here, to make it as close to the real thing as possible, the same size, a head only slightly bigger than my own. I can see him in my mind, the feeling in his eyes. But I can't make it. I'm not good enough with a pencil, a pen. My bloody ankles don't hold a candle to this frustration, the boiling rage inside of me when I review my pathetic scratches on the tear-soaked yellow paper. My drawings don't match the inside of my mind. My heart. The next day, there's a brand new callus on my finger. I stroke it with my thumb. It's soothing, and I want it to deepen. I don't get out of bed to get ready for school.
I pick up the legal pad and start drawing again. I get up extra early every morning to draw John's initials on my neck or my collarbone or my wrist. And then I go outside. I pick up the telegraph and pull it out of the plastic sleeve and smooth it out before I add it to the stack in my room. My parents don't like any of it. The papers, the fake tattoo. I wish I could get a real one. I want a permanent mark on my body. I hate the way people are already forgetting that he was here. I want people to know that I miss him, that I love him, that it's wrong to carry on. They didn't shed a tear for John. Shed. And every day I try to make them all squirm. I chopped my hair into jagged, uneven strips. I stopped shaving my legs, my armpits. I wear chunky black eyeliner and these stiff, bell-bottom, fireproof jeans. The day those jeans arrived, my mom pulled at her hair. None of this will bring him back. I hate when people say that. Obviously, I know this won't bring him back. I realize that cutting my hair won't alter the course of the universe. But I do these things because if and when he does come back, he's going to see how much I miss him. It's all proof. He will gasp, "Chloe, is that you?" I want to look like a different person because I am a different person. And when we hug, I'll be that person that feels like home again. That person I was with him. That person I can't seem to be without him. I bought the fluff book. I can't get into it. It's not the same without his take on it. All fired up. Noelle and Marlene want to help me feel better, but all I want to do is feel worse, to shrivel up, to be the girl who went off the deep end when her best friend disappeared. Noelle stares at my big fake tattoo. "So," she says, "can you go in the water with that thing?" "In what water?" Marlene sighs. "Water whiz," she says. "Class trip?" "Oh," I say. "Yeah, I can go in the water." Noelle bites her lip. "I was kidding," she says. "You gotta lighten up at least a little." Marlene picks up her tray. "I'm sorry," she says. "I have practice." She's sick of this fight. Sick of Noelle lecturing me to smile, wash my hair, go to the mall. "There's a sale at Rolling Jack's. We're gonna get new bathing suits." And I'm sick of being on the other side of this. Sick of saying that I don't want to smile, don't want to wash my hair, I don't want to go to the fucking mall and try on bathing suits. I want to be sad and miserable because my best friend is gone. Noelle picks up her tray. "For the record," she says, "the tattoo on your neck looks stupid and John would be the first one to say it. And if he's even half the person you say he is, he would say you really suck like this, Chloe." In art class, it's easier. People don't know me. They don't care. They like the fact that I'm trying so hard to look fucked up because most of them are doing the same thing. Rosie Ganesh plucks a hair out of her cheek with her fingers. "Got it," she says. "Look at that little fucker." Rosie Ganesh is a freak. She moved here last year, and it's just her and her dad and a bunch of chickens. She has piercings, and she's obsessed with Ian's earring and wears t-shirts with his face plastered all over them. None of her quirks makes any sense. None of it goes together. "Would you ever get a real tattoo?" she asks. "Of course I would," I say. "But they won't let you if you're not old enough." She grins. She's missing one of her bottom teeth. "My aunt's coming this weekend," she says, "with her boyfriend." I stare at her. "So?" "So her boyfriend is a tattoo artist," she says. "He travels with a kit. Do you want a tattoo for real?" At dinner, my mom can tell I have something on my mind. My dad is so different now, so afraid of me. He picks up his plate.
In case you girls want some alone time.
Dad, no, I say. You can stay. He looks at my mom, and she nods. They treat me like I just got home from a mental institution and might start breaking all the lamps in our house at any moment. They don't like my new clothes or the way I never smile. Well, I say, my friend Rosie asked me to sleep over this weekend. My dad chokes on his Coke.
Wow, well, that's great. Who's Rosie?
My mom is tepid. This weekend, she says, but you have water whiz. I'm not gonna go. My mom's heart practically falls onto the table. Thump.
Oh, she says. Well, isn't this a class trip? Didn't I sign a permission slip?
Yes, I say, but it's obviously not a requirement.
But everyone goes.
Not everyone, I say, and it's a lie. Everyone goes, even the kids in art class. It's a big thing in the school, a rite of passage. My mom shakes her head.
You know what I'm going to say.
You don't have to say it.
Chloe, honey, it does you no good to protest things in your life that bring you joy.
It's a stupid water park with piss in the water. Dad, you know that's true. He nods.
Nobody's saying you gotta go in the water, kiddo. But your mother's got a point.
Here it comes. Another lecture on participation. I've heard it all before. My mom's testimony that the best parties are the ones you force yourself to go to, and my dad's proclamation that the bus ride alone would be good for me. Get out of Dodge. Get you out of your head. I pick up my plate and throw it at the wall. I've never done anything like that before. It doesn't break. There was no red sauce. There is no physical mess, only a measly little blob of mashed potatoes. I want my parents to hurt like I do. I want them to miss him. I can't stand how alone I am, and I wish they cried more. I wish they were nicer to his parents, and I wish his parents were nicer to me, and I wish I'd been nicer to him. I might be going crazy. But the missing is too much. It's like a tetanus shot that never ends. This needle in my arm, this ringing in my ears. Where is he? How he is? Why? My mom puts her hand up.
Okay, she says. Okay.
Rosie Ganesh's house is on a scab of land way far away from the center of town. My mom puts the car in park.
Are you sure you feel safe?
I groan and say what she needs to hear. Mom, I'm fine. It's a long walk up the driveway, and my eyes are watering. The whole way here, I was on my phone looking at all the videos from WaterWiz. I feel stupid for being here. Phony. Rosie grins.
Are you getting cold feet?
No, I say. Why? Did your uncle forget the needles or something? She laughs, waves me into her house.
He's not my uncle. He's my aunt's boyfriend.
None of them are what I expected. I was thinking bikers, but they're more like hippies, cooking quinoa and talking GMOs and thrift shops. The tattoo artist boyfriend is Devin, and he has long hair and a smile that eats his whole face. It starts on his forehead and spreads over his skin, pulling it tight. His girlfriend, the aunt, her name's Anita, and she has a lot of tattoos and hair almost as long as Devin's. Rosie's dad is a farmer in overalls. He's a giant, especially next to Skin and Bones, Devin, and Anita. He has a really red face, but it's not from drinking. It's from sun and laughing. They're all so goddamn happy. And Rosie's always with her gloom and doom stories. She's a liar. She's a phony. But then, what am I? I've gone to the bathroom twice already just to see Water Whiz updates. We sit down around a table outside like a normal family, and the aunt's boyfriend catches my eye.
"I'm sorry about your friend," he says.
I look at Rosie, and she shrugs.
"I mean, it's illegal for you to get a tattoo," she says. "I had to tell him what's up."
We eat our veggie burgers and our quinoa, and we talk about John, about other sad stories of kids disappearing, kids kidnapped, the black market, heroin, all the dark things in the world, all the possibilities of where he could be. Why? Rosie says she was really moved by my art. That's how we became such good friends. I look down at my empty plate and I am queasy. All I can think is, I am not your friend. I am no one's friend. Devin stands.
"Okay," he says. "Rosie, I think you should wait here. You ready, Chloe?"
I can't believe what I am doing. I can't believe what I am, who I am, following Devin the tattoo artist around this house I don't know. Devin set his things up in Rosie's art studio. He says he won't say stupid things like relax and breathe. He says this is my chance to ask him anything, anything I want. I blurt out my question. "Do you think John is dead?" He sits in a chair. I can't tell if he's 25 or 45. Beards are weird that way. "The thing is," I start, "if he's not dead, and I mean, I really don't think he's dead, I don't want it to look like it was R.I.P., you know?"
"True," he says, "but a tattoo is really just for you. We can put it someplace small, someplace out of the way. It's nobody's business but yours."
I blush a little. I feel young. Stupid. I never thought of my tattoo as a thing for me. Devin closes his book of fonts. He says it's okay to back out, that we'll tell Rosie that this was his decision. "Thank you," I say. "You're a nice person." He laughs and hugs me and says that I shouldn't believe anyone who tells me it's gonna get better.
"Ride the wave," he says. "Don't wait for it. Don't fear it. Just ride it."
Rosie's no dummy. She knows I wimped out.
"If God himself walked in here and said you could trade me for John, would you do it?"
"Rosie, that's stupid." My non-answer was an answer. And I'm not surprised when she doesn't sit by me in art class the next day. She doesn't ice me out or anything. She says hi and we crack jokes about everyone wearing their stupid Water Whiz shirts. But we both know we aren't friends anymore. It's a thing you can feel. A thing I know well by now. When I see Marlene and Noelle in the hallway, how they've adjusted to being two best friends instead of three. At night, it occurs to me that I officially have no friends. No friends except John. And John always had one friend. He always had me. I pick up the book he was reading when he evaporated, the book about marshmallow fluff. But I fall asleep and dream about Carrig Burkus. In my dream, I have long hair and smooth legs. I wrap around him, tight. My therapist says it's natural for girls to separate lust and love, to rely on John for intimate connection, and lust after Carrig. She says life is a process, a journey, not a destination. That fantasizing about Carrig doesn't mean that I don't miss John.
Now, she says, tell me about your class trip. I know this was going to be a challenge for you. I know it's hard. But tell me about WaterWiz. Did you have fun?
I gulp.
Great, I say, because my whole life is a lie, even the part where you spill your guts. I'm really happy I went. My heart isn't broken, but it's cracked. I had been so loyal, saving every telegraph, drawing him every night. My mother is happy about that. Art is a positive coping mechanism. I would carry the number of days in the front of my head. But things have popped up. Distractions. I got an A in art and they let me move up to a junior seminar. I got the flu. I fell behind in my classes and I forgot to save the telegraphs. And suddenly, I don't know how many days John has been gone. I lost track at some point. All these life events that John missed made me feel less close to him, like this wound was healing and there was nothing I could do about it. My phone rings. I still hope it's John. I always hope it's John. But it's not him. It's never him. It's Marlene's mom, wondering why I didn't RSVP to Marlene's birthday party. I feel my insides heat up in the bad way. I didn't respond because I wasn't invited. I've drifted away from Noel and Marlene, fading into a haze on the floor of my bedroom with my sketch pads. I never said yay for Marlene making number one singles on the tennis team, never helped Noel hang posters for student council. They must feel stung. I take a breath. This is what my mom would call an achievable goal. I promise to go to Marlene's party, and my mom hugs me so hard that night. It's spring, she says. I want to see you have some fun. At the party, I rejoin the land of the living. Me and Noel and Marlene stay up all night talking. Marlene is gooey. We missed you, just like her mom. Noel is wary. She points her Dartmouth pen at me. I think you should sneak downstairs and get us a bottle of Fireball. I tiptoe down the stairs. I open the cabinet. I think of our sunflowers in the backyard, how they lean toward the sun. I think that's what this is. And I like being drunk. Noel says my boobs got bigger. I forgot that I'm a girl, that I'm pretty. I'm not like John. I think of John's eyes, how hard they were to get into, the opposite of Marlene's family's liquor cabinet. I hold the bottle of Fireball and close the cabinet. I hesitate before I go upstairs. This could be my life from now on. Sleepovers and shots. John is probably dead. It doesn't matter that I miss him. It didn't bring him back. Time is passing and I can't stop that from happening with my sketch pads. The next day, I wake up with a hangover. I feel older. I go home and reach under the bed for the box of telegraphs. I carry them outside into the blinding sun and dump them into our trash bin. I catch my breath. I stand there waiting for him to come back. Because isn't that how life works? The second you give up, you get what you want. He doesn't reappear. The trash truck comes, and the papers are really gone. My mom doesn't say anything to me about throwing away the papers, but when I get home from school, I notice that she vacuumed under my bed. Her way of saying thank you.
I kiss a boy at Noel's cousin's party in Manchester. I don't know his name. His tongue is enormous and alive. I don't know John's tongue. Probably never will. Noel kicks my leg at lunch, the Monday after my first kiss since John disappeared. What? I ask. I assume I did something wrong. Nothing, she says. It's just good that you're, like, here. She's bossy, John always said. But bossy can be good. I think she'll run the world, be president or something. She taps her Dartmouth pen on the table. We should hang out at my pool, she says. Sometimes I picture the crack in my heart. It flares up when something reminds me of John. He always said pools are full of germs, even the clean ones, especially Noelle's pool because of the old tiles. Everything is connected to John, and John didn't know how to swim underwater. What babies we were. Everything is John. I snap at Noelle. Your pool is gross. Indoor. A pool is a pool, she argues. And I'm the only person who has one. So we should be the pool people. And we should make sure everyone knows. Boys love pools. Marlene shrugs. I'm there if I can do laps. The last time Noelle tried to make her pool happen, we were in fifth grade. I got an infection in my toe, and I told her John said it was from her pool. She said he was the infection. She knows I'm thinking about him, siding with him. If I fight her indoor pool, I'm not going to see her at all this summer. So, of course, I tell her that I'm in too. Noelle's parents retiled the area around the pool, and Carrig started following me on Instagram and liking the pictures I put up of the pool. And suddenly, this is our life. My mom is happy I'm having a real summer. I like being in a pool. Once you're in the water, you have to stay afloat. It's simple. It's comforting to be somewhere I've never been with John. And maybe the water is sealing up the cracks in my heart. Marlene and Noelle are the best in here. Childish, in the nice way. One night we go to the movies with our wet heads, and we run into them, the boys, the boys, Carrig and Penguin and Eddie Fick. Noelle does all the talking. They are sick of the pond, and they want to go in her pool. It's a miracle, the way they want to be part naked with us. After we hang out with the boys, I go home, and now I can't sleep. I imagine my toes in the water, brushing against Carrig's. It doesn't matter that he's a jerk. He'll be in shorts, no shirt. I should hate him because of how he picked on John. Because of the picture he posted of himself, crouched over a dead deer. He was smiling like a new dad, like a football hero. Hashtag buy Bambi. He defended himself in the comments. Hunting is legal, look it up, dickwad. He oversimplifies things. As a person, he is oversimplified. It all goes together, his attitude, his rifles, and his six packs and his sweatpants. But in that picture of life and death, he was life. There was something forgivable about his smile. He's not a monstrous old dentist extinguishing the life of an endangered species in another country. He's just a kid. A dumb kid. A happy kid. A hunter born in a place where people like to go hunting. You can practically hear his heart beating. Saturday, I wear a red and white two-piece, and my mom says I seem different. I blush. There might be boys today. She smiles. Good. They arrive. No shirts. I'm too shy to look at Care, so I flirt with Eddie, a jock with tiny eyes, soft brains, a giant baby of a boy who could kill you if he wanted to, which he never would, being a giant baby. I always know where Care is, though, and I sense him watching me. Noelle gets first pick, and she goes for Penguin. She's a winner that way, choosing the one who's guaranteed to say, "Hell yeah, kid, come up on me right here." Marlene and Eddie pair off, and then it's just me and Carrig, treading water, hesitating. Stupidest small talk in the world. How's your summer? Good. How's yours? Good. But it feels real. Lump in the throat, kind of heavy. The sound of another world opening up. There is a string pulling us together. I love John. I want Care. My heart must be bigger than normal. Or maybe that's just this pool, this summer. The summer we got boys. The summer John became like an eyelash that gets stuck beneath the lid, that makes me blind and tearful, but eventually falls away. 4 years later.
John. Chloe and I talked about death once. I told her I thought you'd just die. That's it. And she said she thinks you transform into something. Maybe not a bunny, but something. We were both wrong. Death is monotony. A walk in the woods. There is no way to know how long I've been doing this. Mr. Blair lags behind me, and it's always Monday morning in late November. The gray cold, the dead leaves on the ground, shimmying in the sky on their way down. I don't know where we're going. And though we never stop walking, we never get anywhere. And I miss her. I miss her. But I can't cry. There's no crying in these woods. There's no food because there's no hunger. There is no yawning, no sleep. There are no leg cramps or sunsets or fluffernutter frappes. There's no world in our world. It's just me and him. He goads me when I slow down, when he knows I'm thinking about her, when I'm slipping. Come on, John. Steady as she goes. I can't speak. I have no voice. He does, though, muttering about leaves, life. I start to wish I would die, so I wouldn't have to miss her, but I'm already dead. And this is hell because the leaves have teeth, and sometimes they nick me and there is no blood. Only pain. You screwed up, John. You had your chance and you missed it. I look up at the blank canvas of sky, the threat of snow, the crackling hiss that never bottoms out. I wish snow would fall in lumps, making me deaf. You wouldn't be here if you'd told her how you feel, John. You know it. You do. I try to turn my head. I try to talk, but the leaves on the ground flare up. They glow bright green and the electricity seeps through veins and the leaves into me, my veins. Don't turn around, John. I told you there is no going back. You should know by now. But then, everything stops. The leaves hang in the air. As if someone hit pause on the screen of our world. My legs don't move. There is no walking, no talking. I'm choking. My ribs are crushing, cracking. I can't breathe. My throat is full. Marshmallow fluff. I drop to the floor of the dead forest and my windpipe is closing and the sky is hardening, turning to concrete, whitening and stiffening. I didn't want this world, but now I'm losing it. The whiteout inside of me. Outside. And then there is nothing. And then I see red. A deep red in my mind that thwarts everything else. Darker than blood. Pain. I don't know where I am or what happened. But I must be alive because this is the worst pain I've ever known. The searing, pulsing red of my throat. Slowly, the rest of the world comes into focus. The twisted sheets in my hand. The hospital bed beneath my body. But I'm not in a hospital. I'm in a narrow room. The ceiling and walls are concrete, windowless slabs. A halogen light bulb sizzles near my head, and there are dozens of houseplants, ferns like you see at Kmart. I don't know what this place is, this musty underground, but it feels like a basement. I start to think about the last day I remember, the last thing I remember. The woods. Pedro shivering. And then the sub. Roger Blair. He took me. He took me, and here I am. My body on this bed, the pain in my throat, and I realize a breathing tube. He put a breathing tube in me. But why? How? I tear the top sheet off, and to my shock, I'm in normal clothes. Jock things. Track pants and a hoodie. But this isn't the body I know. This body is too big. And this can't be right. This can't be me. My hands are a man's hands, not a boy's hands. Pedro would drown in them now. Pedro. My legs are long, too long for my body. My chest is wide, muscled. I don't fit in my skin, and for a minute I'm not sure this is my skin. Maybe he extracted my soul and shoved it into a dead body. But I know I'm being stupid. I'm me. My left index finger curves like it's trying to get away from my hand. There is hair on my arms. I'm just more of a man now. A coughing man. A tall man. A brawny paper towel man who could unscrew the light bulb and the ceiling fan in our living room. My parents. Where are they? And I sit up in the bed. I pull at the muscles. They're hard. They're not mine. They can't be mine. But they are mine. Under my skin, attached to me, holding me, containing me. How is this possible? How long has it been? And then, Chloe. The wanting is a scream deep inside of me. I remember this thing about life, about feelings, that they are fleeting. They go away whether or not you want them to. I sit and I breathe, and I let the shock ooze out of me. I need a clear head, a calm head. I need to get out of here.